Jewish Audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you go to France today, anybody who's been to Jewish Paris, in perhaps the Pletzl and in other places, you would all see a vibrant Jewish community full of schools, full of shuls, full of yeshivas, and radio so on programs. And so forth. What?
Radio programs
and kosher croissant. However, this evening we are up to the stage in our, I think it's part 16 of our history course, where we are going to look at French Jewry in the 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. Now, although it's advertised slightly differently on the advertisement, I actually found, and it's difficult as I'm summarizing so much history, I actually found that if we're dealing with France, we better had perhaps deal with this time period in France all in one go. And as usual, we're going to look at it in terms of history, which was an extremely sad period, in fact, for the Jews. We're going to look at the Crusades and how the Crusades devastated the Jewish communities. And yet, at the very same time, that period produced geniuses whose works illuminate our learning and traditions even today. Let's start off in the 10th and 11th centuries by Jews then coming to settle in France and Germany, and by and large they were at the whim of local noblemen. Sometimes the Jews were permitted to hold offices, at others they were treated as mere slaves. Let's go straight, however, into a illuminating figure, and in fact I say illuminating because he is called Rabbeinu Gershom Me'or HaGoyla, Rabbi Gershom, the Luminary of the Exile. Born in 960 of the Common Era in Metz in France, Rabbeinu Gershom Ben Yehuda grew to be the light of the exile. As he grew up, he decided that he's not going to stay in Western Europe, he's going to travel east, and in fact he decided he wanted to travel as far as the Babylonian Talmudic Academies, and he moved to Pumpedisa. For those who remember, in our study of the Babylonian era, one of the great centers of Jewish learning in Babylon. After he'd finished studying in Pumpedisa, he then moved to settle in Constantinople in Turkey, which in fact was a very thriving Jewish community at that time. He practiced medicine. However, in order to make a living, he made a living as a goldsmith, who was in fact much sought after. There was an early episode in Constantinople where the local caliph, his daughter, became ill, some mysterious malady, and it was Rabbeinu Gershom who managed to treat her, and in fact nullified a decree of eviction. The caliph had ordered that if the Jews were not able to cure his daughter, they would all be evicted from Constantinople. And one of Rabbeinu Gershom's early claims to fame is that he managed to produce this wonder medicine that in fact cured the girl. However, troubles weren't far and long in coming. Because he was a great goldsmith, he was employed by the Sultan to reproduce for him a replica of Solomon's throne. Now, if you remember when we were studying the period of King Solomon had this wonderful throne, a huge throne, which had, if you want, animated figures all the way up its steps. And the Sultan wanted to have a replica in silver. And whilst Rabbeinu Gershom was constructing this replica, he was accused, of course falsely, of stealing some of the silver. And the Sultan punished him by imprisoning him in a tower. Now, this is a very interesting story in itself. The truth is, it was through an act of perfidy that he managed to get imprisoned in this tower. He was married to one wife. He remained with her for 10 years. They didn't have any children. He then got married to her second wife. He divorced his first wife. He got married to a second wife. And there was a whole story how his second wife basically got him into trouble, and he ended up in seclusion in this tower. The Sultan put him there to perish without any food. To cut a long story short, his first wife came to the tower, and she took a little creature and attached a thread to this creature. The creature ran up the tower, took the thread to Rabbi Gershom, who pulled the thread up, and to that was attached a rope. And using the rope, he managed to lower himself from the tower. So he made a bit of a James Bond escape from the tower through his first wife. You'll see why that's important in a minute. However, running away from Constantinople, he ended up in Mayence in Germany. And there, in Mayence, he founded a yeshiva. And that was at the time of the decline, really, of Babylonian Jewry. And he produced, in this yeshiva in Mayence, some great outstanding Talmidei Chachamim, some great sages, of whom their names were Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Yochor, Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi, and Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yehuda. Now, they sound Jewish names, and sounds a little unfamiliar. However, if you've ever studied Rashi, about whom we shall soon learn, Rashi's commentary on the Talmud, those will be familiar names, because these three, in fact, were to be the teachers of Rashi. Rabbeinu Gershom, let's go back to him, he in fact made a revised edition of the Talmud. This was pre-printing times. He had been in Babylon, and he had seen different texts of the Talmud. And one of his great achievements was to make a revised edition, taking many numerous different texts of the Talmud and correcting them and coming out with the correct reading. Of course, halacha, Jewish law, is very much based on the discussion in the Talmud, and readings which are incorrect can of course lead to an incorrect ruling in the law. You will often find that arguments between the early commentaries on the Talmud were resolved at a later stage by somebody proving or showing that in fact the two disputants had different readings of their text. And in fact it was Rabbeinu Gershom who also copied over and corrected biblical texts. Of course, all this was preserved in scrolls and in handwritten books, and really, in every country, this perhaps was one of the main tasks of the Jews, to preserve these holy writings and to preserve them correctly and in their entirety. He made a commentary on the whole of the Talmud, and he became, in fact, the leading Ashkenaz authority. Ashkenaz meaning Germany, Mayence the greatest yeshiva in Germany then, at the turn of the right at the beginning really of the 11th century. And his most important achievement, Rabbeinu Gershom, was the following. He convened in Mayence a rabbinic assembly to make certain enactments. These were called the Charomim of Rabbeinu Gershom, the excommunications of Rabbeinu Gershom. Why were they called that? Because he made a Charem on anybody who transgressed them. Anybody who transgressed one of these enactments of his based in was to be put in Charem, in excommunication. Now, in rabbinic literature, the word Charem should send a shiver down your spine. Let me just diverge, if I may, for a moment. the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, and in fact it is based on a verse in this week's Sedra. The Sedra this week is Mishpatim, and the Sedra starts off, Ve'eila ha-mishpatim asher tosim lifneiha. These are the laws which you shall set before them, says the Talmud, before them, and not before non-Jewish courts. There is a prohibition in Jewish law for litigants initially to go to a non-Jewish court to settle Jewish disputes. We must initially go to a Beth Din. And the order will be that a man will go to the Beth Din and he'll say, look, I've got a problem with Reuven, he didn't pay me my rent, and he should have done. So the Beth Din will send a note to Reuven and say, Reuven, you are summoned to the Beth Din. And Reuven will send a note back, says, thank you very much, but no thank you. And the Beth Din will say, send him a letter, well, Reuven, if you do not come, then you will be in contempt of court, what is called in Hebrew a mesarev, a refusal to come to court. And if you refuse further, then in fact you can have a shamta or a cherem put on you in the extreme. That is, in early times you would have been excommunicated. And then it was very, very severe. Some of you may have seen the picture, famous picture of Spinoza being in excommunication, of people sort of keeping their distance from him. Certainly in medieval times, if a Jew was excommunicated by a leading rabbinic court, nobody would walk in his four cubits, and he wasn't allowed to be part of the minyan of the synagogue, and so it was a very, very heavy duty punishment, or communal punishment. Today, of course, those who are following the front pages of the Jewish tabloids will no doubt follow the Aguna case, and no doubt have heard of, is it possible to wringle out a get through somebody through an act of a cherem. In the olden days that would have been much more possible. In fact, in the olden days, strictly according to Jewish law, a recalcitrant husband would simply have been beaten up by the Jewish authorities. That is a halacha in Rambam, which people are really not aware of. The halacha says that the man halachically must give a get, and he doesn't, then the Beth Din has the power to get the Jewish bother boys out and work this guy over until he does give a get. That is the halacha ruled in Maimonides and in the Code of Jewish Law. Unfortunately, civil law here in England doesn't allow such a thing, and then you have the Aguna problem. However, in America, you have less of a problem because the American bother boys are perhaps more well-trained and better equipped than we are this side of the pond. Now, let's go... the mitzvah tanks in. That's right. Well, we use our tanks for slightly different types of tanks. Now, let's have a look at some of these charomim, some of these enactments which Rabbeinu Gershom made. Of course, if a person transgressed them, you would have been a chayim. Most important, the ban against polygamy. Until those days, it was permitted for a Jewish man to marry more than one wife. This is, of course, biblical in origin. We find that many of our patriarchs married more than one wife. Jacob, of course, did even more than that. He married two sisters, which is even more problematic, but that was prior to the giving of the Torah. However, post-Sinai halacha says that a man may marry more than one wife if he can keep up the necessary she'era kesusa ve'oinasa that is necessary. That's also a quote from this week's Sedra. A husband is obligated to provide his wife with food, clothing, and conjugal rights. And if he can provide this provision for more than one wife, then he's allowed to marry more than one wife. However, it was Rabbeinu Gershom who made a ban against polygamy for various reasons. First of all, he had his personal story. That's why I mentioned beforehand this story of Perfidy, which got him out of the tower in Constantinople. But more than that, but he saw the pitfall perhaps of marrying two wives. Do you know something? I'm not sure whether he did give her a get or whether he actually just married an additional wife. I can't remember. I might stand corrected. Good point. I'll have to look that up. What was happening, because of the lack of communication, internet, email, and other various forms of communications, in fact the phone still works, they didn't have any communication between two cities. A man, a Jew, Yaakov, let's say, would go to Paris, marry a woman, Rivka, and have children, have a boy, Yitzchak. And then he would go off to Mayence, Germany, and marry another lady called Leah, and have a girl called Baracha. And Yitzchak and Baracha, Yitzchak of Paris and Baracha of Mayence, are in fact technically brother and sister and not allowed to marry each other. However, because of the such poor communications and, of course, lack of often use of family names, which were only used later, people were called Yitzchak ben Yehuda, or whatever their father's name was, brothers and sisters, or there was the danger, great danger, of brothers and sisters marrying, particularly because Jewish communities were becoming more displaced at that time. It wasn't like in Israel where there was a yeshuv, where people lived for hundreds of generations. It wasn't like Babylon where there was a great tradition. Unfortunately, because of the times, the Jewish communities were almost constantly on the run, or being uprooted, or being attacked, or ravaged by the Crusaders. And therefore, because they were on the run, he made this enactment that a man may not have more than one wife. Now, it's interesting that this was at the turn of this millennium, if you think. So the ban against polygamy is really only 1,000 years old. Now, there is a fascinating discussion as to, did Rabbeinu Gershom make his ban forever? And can it be repealed? Now, according to some authorities, it was only a ban for a certain amount of time. According to others, it was only accepted in the communities of Ashkenaz, but not in the communities of Sephorad. Sephorad literally translated Spain, but including North Africa and Egypt, Yemen, and so on. Oriental Jewry, Babylonian Jewry, was it accepted by them? And in fact, even until a few hundred years ago, you did have cases of other segments, particularly Sephardic Jewry, where it was still commonplace for a man to have more than one wife, which was an indication that they did not, or had not heard even, of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. Another decree of his was that he banned divorcing a woman without her free consent. This is an interesting halacha, and that is, biblically speaking, if a man wants to divorce his wife without her consent, he can do so. He can give her a bill of divorce, a get, against her consent. However, Rabbeinu Gershom, for various reasons, banned that, and today it must be only with the consent of the wife that she be divorced. He banned opening the letters of another person. You're not allowed to open your friend's mail without his permission. I presume that would go on email as well, although that wasn't around in the times of Rabbeinu Gershom, so hacking would most definitely be prohibited, or having a look what's written. So the others, there of course there are bills and laws in this country about that sort of thing, but there you have it. In those days, when all letters were signed and sealed with wax or whatever it was, to open another person's letter, you were under that chedem. Or, for example, he said you would be in chedem if you made an unauthorized change in a Talmudic text. If you started fiddling around with the text and you started making different changes, again you would be in his chedem. And that, of course, is very important, because it was of prime importance to the leading sages of the time to make sure that the texts of the Talmud and the biblical texts would go down the generations in their entirety without being changed or tampered with. He did live through great periods of persecution. In 1012, there was a decree that all the Jews of the city, his place, either convert to Christianity or go into exile. The majority of them chose to go into exile. He composed many piyutim. Piyut is a poem, and selichos, penitential prayers, some of which we recite on the 9th of Av, some of which we recite during the lead up to the High Holy Days. And he also put a ban on people discriminating against forced converts coming back to Judaism. Now, this was an interesting one, because the communities, particularly the Crusaders, did give the Jewish communities the choice: either die or convert. And a few did choose conversion. They were discriminated against by other Jewish communities, as if to say, well, you know, you should have chosen the path of dying al Kiddush Hashem, giving up your life in the sanctification of God's name, which most did. However, Rabbeinu Gershom had the, perhaps we should say, the broader vision of re-embracing or embracing these people, and he died in the year 1040, which at the age of 80, the leading Ashkenaz authority, Rabbeinu Gershom Me'or HaGoyla, Rabbi Gershom, the luminary of the exile. And in fact, it was he who had started or built the biggest yeshiva in Germany, which made Germany an important center. But perhaps, most importantly, we'll now move on to Rabbeinu Gershom dying in 1040, his having three great students, and in 1040, the year he died, and in fact the year that Rav Hai Goin, one of the great Gaonim of the Babylonian Academy, also died in the year 1040. But do you remember I've told you numerous times the law of Jewish history? V'zorach HaShemesh u'bor HaShemesh. The sun sets and the sun rises. It's not for nothing Fiddler of the Roof had the song Sunrise, Sunset in it, because that is the story of Jewish history. In the year 1040, Rabbi Gershom dies and Rashi is born. Rashi. The name Rashi is a household name. It stands for Reb Shlomo Yitzchaki. This man was called Shlomo. His father was called Yitzchak. Shlomo ben Yitzchak, or Reb Shlomo Yitzchaki. He was Yitzchak's Shlomo. He was born in, now I never can pronounce this name, I always say Troyes, but it's Tresh or Troyes or T-R-O-Y-E-S. Let's say Troyes, because that's the, I suppose that's the easiest English, Troyes, or I'm not sure exactly what the Troyes, what the exact French pronunciation of it. His mother, Rashi's mother, was a sister of Reb Shimon ben Yitzchak, a student of Rabbeinu Gershom Me'or HaGoyla. Rashi, through his father, could trace his lineage all the way back to the kingdom of David. He was of Davidic descent, like Maimonides. And in fact, we've seen this as well, that Malchus, kingship, sovereignty, may not have been an actual king, but kingship in sense of work, was always through Davidic descent. There is a beautiful story called Reb Yitzchak's Jewel. Rashi's father was called Yitzchak. Yitzchak and his wife, Mrs. Yitzchak, were an elderly couple who, unfortunately, were not blessed with children. And they had difficulty, in great difficulty, in making any sort of living whatsoever. And once Rabbi Yitzchak was scrounging around for some way of making a living, and he couldn't even bring bread into the house, let alone anything else. And he never lost his bitachon, he never lost his trust in God. And one day, as the story goes, he was walking in an area in France, and he perchanced upon, buried in the sand, or just gleaming in the sand, a most beautiful and exquisite diamond, a large diamond. He had it, he took it to the local jeweler, and it was proclaimed that this diamond is one of the most expensive diamonds perhaps in the entire world, fit for a crown. And the story goes that the fame of this diamond spread, and the local minister of the church wanted to buy this diamond in order to place it inside as an eye of one of the, I suppose you could call it an idol, I'm not sure what it's called, in church or whatever it is. He wanted to put it in one of the
a statue,
whatever one. When Rabbi Yitzchak heard this, and he was willing to buy for any money, he was very distraught. Thought, is this why Hashem's given it to me, that I should use it for her? So he didn't know what to do. Anyway, the story goes that they called him, that the king, in fact, himself wanted to have a look at this diamond, and he was taken on a ship. And on the ship, traveling could have been in the sea or up a river, he was then forced to sell the idol, to sell the diamond to the authorities. And what he did, he's offered a huge sum of money, yet he said, hold on a minute, before I sell it to you, I just want to show it to you. And he took it out and he held it over the deck of the ship, and he held it up so that everybody could see the brilliance of the diamond in the light of the sun. And then, whoops, by mistake, dropped it into the water, and it was lost forever. And it was an accident, well, so they thought, it was an accident on purpose on his behalf. And he lost what was potentially a personal fortune, and it was in a way that it didn't cause them to have the idol, to have the diamond for the idol either. A heavenly voice proclaimed, Rabbi Yitzchak, since you've had great mesidas nefesh, great self-sacrifice in giving up this immense fortune, you will be granted a son who will become a luminary, who will illuminate all of Judaism forever. And in fact, although he and his wife were elderly, they were blessed with a son whom they called Shlomo. And this, in fact, grew up to be Rashi. Rashi, in his young years, studied at the yeshivas of Troyes, of Mayence, Worms, Speyer, and he lived a life of paspa melach toichal, like it says in the Ethics of the Fathers, if you want to acquire Torah, then you must eat bread and salt, and drink just water, sleep on the ground. He lived in abject poverty, but at the same time, drawing on the great teachings and living with the teachers. And at the age of 25, he settled in Troyes, and he earned a living from selling fruits and wines. In fact, he was a wine merchant. And he established a yeshiva in Troyes, where he taught students for 40 years. 10 years into, in fact, the yeshiva, at the age of 35, Rashi felt the great need that a commentary be written on the Talmud which would elucidate the Talmud for the people of his day. And you see, the problem was that the Jews had moved from Babylon, where most of them spoke Aramaic and were well conversant also with Hebrew, and they'd moved into Western Europe, where most people spoke French and Hebrew, or Arabic and Hebrew, certainly in the southern lands, but where he was in France, it was French and Hebrew. And the Babylonian Talmud, which of course is the wellspring of Jewish law, was now becoming almost a closed text. But before he embarked on such a mission to write a voluminous commentary on the Talmud, he decided that he's going to travel through the Jewish world to find if anybody had preceded him. Or, and in addition, to grow and learn by the great Jews, by other great Jews, and see if any other similar commentaries had been made, or if anybody could give him new ideas and teachings. And so he went what's called into galus, which was quite usual at the time. He put himself into a self-imposed exile, where he travelled to Greece, he travelled to Israel, Egypt, and to Persia to seek commentaries on the Tanakh and on the Talmud. And upon his return to Troyes, which is a huge journey if you think about it, and of course travelling through all those different lands gave him a great insight into the Jewish life of those lands, and of course into the languages of those lands. And that was very important, because that global knowledge was important for him to be able to take other commentaries, and he picked up other commentaries as he went on the way, commentaries which were available, of course, only in handwriting, but he picked them up on the way. And upon return to Troyes, he started his two great commentaries, one on the Chumash and one on the, not just the Chumash, one on the Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, and Kesuvim, and one on the Talmud. Now, these commentaries placed Rashi in the position of the commentator par excellence. The heavenly voice, which we mentioned above, was fulfilled. Rashi is simple, he's concise, he's got a lucid style. He became to be known as the Parshan Dosa, the expounder of the Torah. He gave pshat. In fact, Rashi is also an acronym for Rabbon Shel Yisrael, the rabbi of all Israel, the teacher of all Israel, because the explanation of Rashi, although all drawn from the earlier Midrashic and Talmudic texts, is so clear and is so concise. In fact, he writes, for example, in his Pirush, on his commentary on Chumash, he writes, "Ani lo bosi el lefarish pshuto shel mikra. I only come to give the simple meaning of the text to a five-year-old." Even a five-year-old, when a five-year-old learns Chumash, he'll have certain questions, and my commentary will explain those questions. Let me say that there are over 200 commentaries on the commentary of Rashi on Chumash. Delving into Rashi, seeing what was Rashi's question. You see, Rashi doesn't ask the question and give an answer. He makes a short comment where, or in which, your question is asked and automatically resolved, sometimes in a word or in a few words. But to see the brilliance in that, other commentaries will say Rashi was bothered by this point, and this is what he answers. And Rashi doesn't quote most of his commentary source material. He weaves it, so to speak, into the text. And today there is no edition of the Chumash which is printed without the commentary of Rashi. In fact, the first Hebrew book printed in 1479 by Reggio de Calabria was a Chumash Rashi. Isn't that interesting? First, in fact, Hebrew book that ever went into print. By the way, many of you will know that Rashi is acclaimed to have had a specific script which is called Rashi script. If you open up an edition of the Talmud or many of its later commentaries, you'll find it in a certain handwriting which is called Rashi script. The truth is, it was attributed to Rashi, but it's a mistake. It was in fact the script which the printer in 1479 took and adopted to print Rashi in. In fact, Rashi had a different script, but it's been universally called Rashi's script because in the first printing it was printed in that specific script. Rashi in his commentary focuses on grammar. He bases himself very much on the early Spanish grammarians of Menachem ben Siruk and Dunash Halevi ben Labrat, quoting them often. He says, "Menachem Pirush, Menachem explains," and he often refers to Unklus. Do you remember Unklus, the proselyte who gave, he was the first one to translate the entire Bible into Aramaic. So he'll often quote how Unklus understands a word, and how Menachem may have understood a word, and then he'll give his own explanation. Now what is genius in Rashi? You'll often find that Rashi will bring a word, and will quote to you will quote you another six places in Tanakh where you have that same word or a similar word. Now, we have a book, I have a book here in the library called A Concordancia, A Concordance, and it is a book where, let's take the word lechem, bread. I highly doubt it if anybody in this room, including myself, could quote to me off the top of his head every single place in the entire scriptures where the word lechem is mentioned. Okay, but this book does it for you. It's a concordancia, that's the point of the book. Rashi was a human concordancia. He had this unbelievable grasp of the entire scriptures and wrote his commentary on the entire scriptures, which was a great feat. Nobody could ever and has ever reproduced such an amazing lucid commentary on the Chumash as Rashi did. And that's why 5-year-olds, when or 5, 6, 7-year-olds today, in school, you learn Chumash and then you learn Rashi. Rivka's learning Chumash and Rashi, right?
Yeah.
You learn Chumash and you learn Rashi. You can't learn Chumash without Rashi today. The Talmud is, of course, even more voluminous. If you just simply wanted to write a commentary on the Talmud, let's say I gave you a commentary, let's say I gave you the Steinsaltz Talmud, just to copy out, you'd be spending half your day writing, right? Just to write, simply physically, let alone study it, and let alone appreciate it, let alone digest it, just to write it. Of course, Rashi had a great advantage. He had three daughters who helped him. He did not have any sons, but he had three daughters, all of whom were great sages in their own right, and they were his transcribers in the main. Those three daughters which he had, he dictated to them, and he then corrected their texts. And Rashi's commentary on the Talmud, again, is not a halachic work. He doesn't summarize the law, but what he does, he takes you line by line, word by word, through the Talmud. And again, it would have been a closed book had we not had his commentary. In every single edition of the Talmud, on every single page, you've got the Talmud, and in the middle, you have two columns, the comment of Rashi on the Talmud. And again, in his commentary, even in a few words, he will ask a question and give an answer without you even noticing it. But later, when you go over it, you see the brilliance in that he's already led you down the correct path before you've studied it falsely. All the great commentaries always show, or if you want, illuminate how Rashi learned, or how Tosfos learned, as we'll learn soon. He did also, in addition to writing commentaries, write many halachic responsa, questions and answers, which were posed to him, although he's known in the main for his commentaries on the Bible and the Talmud, rather than for his responsa. He lived till the age of 65 in the year 1105, and even in his final illness was still dictating to his daughters a comment on the Talmud. In fact, it was so precise, he finished on a particular word. He was learning commentating on the tractate Makos, and he finished, the last word he dictated to his daughter was the word Tohoir. The word Tohoir meaning pure. And then his soul left his body. And in fact, we find that his son-in-laws, Rashi's daughter's husbands, and his grandchildren finished his commentary, as we'll soon learn. There's a special shul in the city of Vermeza, which was which had in fact the chair upon which Rashi sat. That unfortunately, however, was destroyed by the Nazis in the war. Although one can today visit the tomb of Rashi, and it can be said of Rashi that Rashi is and still remains the commentator par excellence on the Chumash and on the Tanakh. And I think I've mentioned to this to you beforehand, that my teacher told me that the Almighty created you with two forefingers on both hands, one to keep your place in the Talmud and one to keep your place on Rashi. So that's how popular and important Rashi is. After Rashi passed from this world, his son-in-laws and grandchildren became known as the Tosafists. The word Tosafists means supplementary commentaries, because they supplemented the comments of Rashi on the Talmud. His sons-in-law were people called Reb Meir ben Shmuel, Reb Yehuda ben Noson, otherwise known as the Rivan. His grandsons were Reb Shmuel, the Rashbam, Reb Yitzchak, the Rivam, and a very important one called Rabbeinu Yaakov, also known as the Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam. Now, the works of the grandsons and thereafter of Rashi, these Tosafists, these supplementary commentaries, went on for about 150 years, altogether totaling about 300 great sages. And what they did was the following. Rashi initially, when he was writing his commentary, wrote Kuntresim. Kuntresim means little books on each tractate, which eventually was put together. But he was giving the pshat, he was giving the simple understanding of the text. These additional commentaries, first of all, sometimes differed with Rashi, and at other times started asking contradictions between places in the Talmud. And in the Vilna edition of the Talmud, which is this edition over here, which we have, you have the Talmud in the middle, Rashi next to it, and on the other side, the comments of Tosfos. These are the grandchildren of Rashi, and Tosfos has a much different style. It's a style of pilpul, a new Jewish learning style. Pilpul comes from the word pilpel. Pilpel in Hebrew means pepper. Pilpul means incisive learning, question, answer, contradiction, elucidation. And rather than explaining the simple meaning, it's in fact, you can learn sometimes a long Tosfos, where Tosfos can ask up to 20, 30 questions and give different answers and different suggestions, and it can get very, very complicated. But it's very geschmack, it's extremely intellectually stimulating to learn through a Tosfos. And so what you have in today, in the yeshivas of the world, most of students study Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos. Of course, that doesn't help to get the final halacha. What you do is you've learnt all the background. After you've studied the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, you then need to go on to study the text which we mentioned last week, which summarized the halacha for you, such as Rambam, Maimonides, Rif, and Rosh, and others. And eventually you'll learn codes which we haven't spoken about yet. We'll get to it later on when we speak about the great period of Tzfas, the code of the Jewish law. Rabbeinu Tam, I mention him in particular, he was born in Rameru in France in the year 1100. His mother, Yocheved, a daughter of Rashi, in fact was 60 years old when she gave birth to this boy Yaakov. And he was called Rabbeinu Tam, which means our simple master, after Yaakov Avinu, after the patriarch Jacob, who is called the Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Eholim. Jacob was called a simple man, a dweller of tents, because he was such a pious personality. After his father died, Rabbeinu Tam became the Rosh Hashiva of Rameru. He made interesting synods to enact decrees, and in 1147, we'll soon learn, when the Crusaders rampaged through Rameru, they wounded him seriously. He managed to escape to Troyes, and in 1149 completed a book called the Sefer HaYoshar, Commentaries on the Talmud, and he died on the 4th of Tammuz, 1171, aged 71. Today, Rabbeinu Tam is known for a number of enactments, but one of the interesting things, let me just tell you an interesting thing, that is, when we put on tefillin in the morning, we actually put on, most of us put on what's called Rashi's tefillin. What do I mean? There are four parashiyos, four scrolls, or four places in the Torah where the Torah mentions the word tefillin. They're called totophos in the Chumash. Tefillin is an Aramaic word. There are four places. Now there is an argument as to which is the order of these four parashiyos in the Tefillin. Now one would think that they are in the order in which they're written in the Chumash. Kaddish, Vahoye Kaviyacha, Shema, and Vahoyim Shemaya. That is the order which Rashi says. Rabbeinu Tam, however, the grandson of Rashi, disagreed with his grandfather and said that the order should be different. Instead of being 1, 2, 3, 4, it should be 1, 2, 4, 3. And therefore, how could he disagree with his grandfather? You know, I mean, didn't he have a pair of his grandfather's tefillin? And apparently there were two different customs in the Jewish world. After Rashi, it was decided in the main to have this order of 1, 2, 3, 4, but some people, in fact today, many, mostly Hasidim, put on two pairs of tefillin daily. Rashi and Rabbeinu Tams. So if you ever see a person, after he's finished putting on one pair of tefillin and wrapping them up, and then putting on another pair of tefillin, he's not just repeating the exercise. He's in fact putting on a different pair of tefillin where the order of the parasha is different. And this has also Kabbalistic connotations, which we won't go into now. So we've studied about Rabbeinu Gershom Meir HaGoyla, and we've studied about Rashi. We've neglected slightly the history of the period, and from now till the end I'm going to focus on that. In general, from the 11th century and onwards, Jews spread throughout Western Europe. And as the influence of the Christian church spread, so did the persecution of the Jews. At the end of the 11th century was ushered in two centuries of suffering and martyrdom for the Jews, the period of the Crusades. Let us look at the first crusade, which was in the year 1096. It started with the capture of Israel. Say Israel, shouldn't really call it Eretz Yisrael or Palestine as it was known then, by Muslim Turks. And the Pope then decreed that in order to get the infidel out, it was necessary to start a jihad. Although 95, Pope Urban II called for this holy war. He promised remission of sins, eternal life for anybody who would go on the crusade. Now, many people were aroused to this call, all of whom, however, for different motives. French and Italian merchants saw this call as a chance to destroy the Jewish monopoly of commerce in Europe. Knights, men of arms, saw in the crusade the opportunity to acquire land. The masses sought salvation, criminals sought crime, and anyway, war was an escape from the misery, famine, and pestilence which had plagued Europe at that time. Evangelistic priests, one of them called Peter the Hermit, swelled the ranks of the Crusades. And it seemed rather illogical to risk all their lives and possessions to go and destroy the infidel whilst the Jews, the local Jews, who were also an enemy, and they were also the infidel here, remained unmolested. So why not start the holy mission right here at home? Let's first punish the murderers of the Saviour before fighting the Muslims. The Jewish community in the Rhenish Valley was started on first by this rabble. 800 Jews were killed in Vermeza, Worms. 1,000 Jews in Mayence. Many communities committed suicide even before the Crusaders attacked. All, in 3 months in the year 1095, 10,000 Jews died through rampage, literally, of the Crusaders throughout that valley. The mob entered Bohemia and destroyed the Jewish communities of Regensburg and Prague. And the climax came in the year 1099 when a man called Godfrey de Bouillon fought his way into Jerusalem, drove out the Muslim infidel, also drove the Jews into their synagogue and burned them all alive. The Jewish community in Jerusalem ceased for many, many years. And at the end of this first crusade, the Crusaders held a strip 500 miles long, going from Tigris River in the north, the source of the Tigris, all the way down to Egypt. A strip 500 miles long and 50 miles wide. A reprieve came when Henry IV from Italy came to power. He decided that in order for commerce purposes, it was necessary to bring the Jews back, give them a bit of breathing space, and he restored their status, and the Jews started to recover somewhat from the devastating effects of the First Crusade. But it was not for long. In the year 1144, a mere 40 years or so after the First Crusade, the communities really had not yet recovered when a new crusade to defend the Holy Land from the infidel was started. Again, the Pope promised eternal salvation, but his promise was not enough to raise an army. The Pope made a new decree. Any crusader who went on the crusade did not have to pay any interest to the Jews. If you borrowed money, you didn't have to pay interest. Perhaps you didn't even have to pay at all. This was very appealing to many kings, because they owed a lot of money to the Jews. Louis VII of France, Conrad III of Germany, all joined in. The leading this crusade was a man of Bernard of Clairvaux, and this rabble again fell on the communities of Worms and Mainz. And the Jews of France, interesting enough, suffered less than the Jews of Germany, rather because certain kings were involved, so they managed to control certain areas. Certainly, less people were killed in the Second Crusade than the First Crusade. The actual crusade itself was a dismal failure, but what they managed to do en route was a success. In 1187, a third crusade came along. Jerusalem fell to Saladin, the Sultan of Egypt. In 1189, three kings, Frederick of Germany, Philip Augustus of France, and Richard the Lionheart of England, decided that they've got to go on this crusade. Huge sums of money poured into the coffers of Frederick by the Jews, of course. They paid for the crusade. And he decreed that they not be harmed. If they're paying for it, at least give them the breather of not being involved in it. However, in local England at home, at the coronation of Richard the Lionheart, a rumour spread that the king had ordered Jews to be attacked prior to his embarking on the crusade. Jews were murdered, yes, in London. The king quelled the riots and ordered nobody to molest the Jews. But as soon as the king had left, the crusade riots spread through Norwich, Lynn, Dunstable, Stamford, and York. 150 Jews in Clifford's Tower in York, led by Rabbi Yom Tov of Joini, it's difficult to say the word again, took refuge, of course, in Clifford's Tower for 6 days. They held out. However, at the end of 6 days, they felt that it was better to commit suicide than to submit to the mob. I'm sure many of you have visited Clifford's Tower in York and seen the plaque, seen the place. A few of them were left. Not all of them committed suicide. As soon as they opened gates, the mob immediately slaughtered them and burned all records of debts which had accumulated, which people had owed the Jews money. Of course, that debt was cancelled. This across-the-board martyrdom of Jews is immortalized every Shabbos in our synagogue. Because after the Haftorah, after the reading of the Torah and the Haftorah, we say a prayer called Yukum Purukon Min Shemaya in Aramaic for all the great academies and the rabbis, their wives and students and the communities And then immediately after that, on most Shabbosos, we read a prayer called Av HaRachamim. Av HaRachamim, Merciful Father, a tribute to all those communities who gave up their lives Al Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying their lives instead of converting to Christianity. Now, the Crusades, understand, brought about a change of status for the Jew. Until the Crusades, the Jews were international merchants. Of course, there was a Jewish, if you want, point of trade at each year. It was fantastic. Jews had an internet of traders. You just went to Fez or Calabria, wherever it was, and of course the local shul, that was the place where everything was going on. They were craftsmen. They were protected, some of them, by the king even, because the king wanted them or needed them. But the Crusades brought about the envy of the Gentile merchants, who pushed the Jews out of their trades. The Jews were viewed as unwanted competitors, and the Jews, out of lack of anything else, had to move into finance, banking, money lending. But you must realize, although it's quite a useful service, money lending creates a natural antipathy between the debtor and the creditor. You always hate the person you have to pay back. Coupled with the hatred of the Christian to the Jew, this turned the Jew from the status of a respected merchant to a demonic usurer. What was the Jew viewed as? The one that wanted your money. You had to pay him back. Well, if you had a good excuse not to pay him back, get rid of him. Now, we had a phenomenon which occurred at this time which took many, many Jewish lives. The blood libel. It was an absurd accusation. Jews are told many times in the Chumash, you're not allowed to eat blood. After an animal is slaughtered, we salt the chicken or the cow, whatever it is, to extract the blood. We're not allowed to eat the blood. How much more so blood straight from an animal? And yet this absurd accusation, in fact, started in England. In Norwich in the year 1144 was the first Alilas Dom, the first blood libel, and in fact went on right throughout into medieval years, right to almost the 16th century. In fact, there are reports even later of blood libels. What was the libel? Just before Pesach, the Jews would kill a local Christian child, take some of his blood, and mix the blood into the flour and the water for the baking of the matzahs. It's ridiculous. First of all, we have strict rules that only flour and water is allowed in matzah. And second of all, we're not allowed to eat any blood. So why they should pick on this, and why should they pick on matzah? Many interesting explanations have been given. Some say it was started in Egypt by the dipping of the blood on the doorposts of the house. That was the sign that God was to pass over the houses of the Jews and only. So because of that dipping of the blood, therefore we put a bit of blood, if you want, in the matzah to remind us of that blood. All sorts of different things. But it was absurd. It was an absurd accusation. And yet in 1144 in Norwich, the Jews died because of it. In Blois, in France, in 1171, every single Jew in the town was burned at the stake. And in many communities, life was only ensured by paying a massive tribute to the noble or king. In fact, Jews became vassals of the kings, who could arbitrarily dispose of their lives. They were almost like chattels to be used for when you needed them and disposed of when you'd had enough of them. In the 13th century, it was Louis VII that reigned until 1180. He recognized the value of the Jew. His son Augustus, however, persecuted the Jews and demanded huge ransoms, as we said, for their personal safety. Thank God he only controlled Paris and its environs. Louis the Ninth was an interesting character. He was a very religious fellow, a very frum guy. Very pious. In fact, after his death, he was called Saint Louis. Virulently anti-Semitic, and loved seeing Jews die at the stake. It's interesting. The Rebbe, whenever he would write a letter to Saint Louis, would never write St. Louis. Would always write S. Louis. He wouldn't even say the word that this was a saint, to say that that this person was a saint, because although he was a pious Catholic, the fact is, as much as he was pious, he was also incredibly anti-Semitic against the Jews. Now, something which perhaps came to its peak at this time was papal power. Of course, the Bishop of Rome had always had an influential spot in the Christian world, but at this time there rose the notion that the Pope, in fact, was the world leader, and in fact his influence not only could spread to religion, but also political power. Interestingly enough, in the 13th century, with a pope called Innocent III, not sure how innocent he was, but he was from 1198 to 1216, he put forward the idea that the pope was the world ruler. Part of his ruling was to instigate a fourth crusade, and he brought in what was called a Lateran Council, which made loads of decrees on Jews. I'll just read out some of them. Jews could no longer hold public office nor employ Christian domestics. They couldn't charge high rates of interest. Crusaders were released from all payments of debts. Laxity and observance of their faith, of their new faith, would result in punishment for baptized Jews, and a special tax for the support of the local church which would be levied against any Jew buying a house from a Christian. It was all to do with money, wasn't it? We ended up paying for half of the church as well. And this is the religion which preaches kindness and acceptance of all men. We must never, I believe, as Jews, lose the focus of the Crusades. The Christian church, however glamorous it appears to be, and what it offers the Jew. But when people say, and it makes me cringe, Jews for Jesus, we have to realize, just go back to the period of the Crusades, to realize what Catholicism in particular, the Pope and others, did to the Jews. And of course it doesn't take much thinking of what happened in the Second World War, which we'll learn when we come much later in the Jewish history, how the Pope could have done something. It's well known that the German officer in Rome at the time was very afraid of the Vatican as to what the Pope would say. However, when he said nothing, it was almost a silence real to what was going to take place. The worst and perhaps the most what's the word when you put somebody down? The most humiliating decree, perhaps, which they made then, was the wearing of a badge. The badge of the Jew. The yellow patch. And in some cases, the yellow star. An invention invented by the papal powers, reincarnated by Nazis. It all started off when a malicious apostate, a man called Nicholas Donin, denounced the Talmud to the authorities. There was a great disputation in Paris in the year 1240. And although many great sages tried to dispel rumors and malicious accusations against the contents of the Talmud, in the year 1242, 24 wagon loads of books and sacred texts of the Jews were burned publicly in Paris. In fact, they were eulogized by Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg in a special eulogy which we make on the 9th of Av for them. But surprisingly enough, throughout the Crusades and throughout this time, Jewish learning was on the increase. And perhaps we could suggest that persecution of this magnitude could only be endured because of our clinging to the Torah. At this time, there was an interesting man called the Ri HaZokein. He had an interesting yeshiva. It had 60 students in it. And because the Talmud was being publicly burnt, he got each student to memorize one tractate of the Talmud. And of course, there were 60 tractates altogether. And so therefore, he had a yeshiva where he literally got 60 CD-ROMs who had memorized entire tracts. And so therefore, as wherever he moved with his yeshiva, he had the entire Talmud with him. There was a great rabbi of Paris called Reb Yechiel of Paris. He had a yeshiva of 300 students, and he had to lecture all by heart because the church had seized all the volumes of the Talmud. In fact, he left for Israel and died in Israel. Great works were composed at those times. Reb Moshe Mikutzi arranged the mitzvahs in a book called Sefer Mitzvah Sagodol. I think I mentioned this too last week. Although the Talmud says there are 613 commandments, nobody ever enumerated them. Maimonides did in his book called the Book of Mitzvahs. Rabbi Moshe Mikutzi from France also enumerated them, and Rabbi Yitzchak of Korveil also enumerated them and made a work for scholarly laymen giving the mitzvah and a few of its applications. So in fact, great Jewish works which are still used today were made at this devastating time. The suffering of French Jewry reached its climax during the reign of Philip IV. He ruled from 1285 to 1314. He was called Peter the Fair. The wars against England and Flanders had left the king without any money, and he, in the year 1294, made a decree that all Jews have to live in specific quarters. In 1306, he arrested all the Jews, took all their property, and issued an edict of expulsion by July the 22nd in the year 1106. Surprise, surprise, the 9th of Av. Of course, we know that's the day of national calamity. In fact, it took place on the 10th of Av that the Jews walked out. 100,000 Jews were banished from France in the year 1306. A place they'd lived in for 1,000 years, taking only the clothes on their back. In 1315, Louis X allowed readmission of the Jews for 12 years. In 1320, there was a new crusade. 1322, there was a libel by lepers. A whole very interesting story that the Jews had caused the leprosy, which was common then. In 1359, the Jews were again readmitted, but Charles VI, in 1394, again finally kicked them all out on Yom Kippur. And in fact, Jews, or I hate to say this, but France was Judenfrei, was Jew-free for almost 300 years. An amazing thing. They'd been there for over 1,000 years, but because of the Crusades and everything, we'd been sent out and weren't to return for 300 years. One wouldn't think so, as I said beforehand, going down the streets of Paris. Let's finish on a good note.
Where did they go?
Well, they went to Germany, and they went wherever they could, wherever anybody would let them in. If you think about it, what is causing neo-Nazism today in Europe? It's the influx of immigrants. It always has been the immigrant that has disturbed the local populace. Well, when you have 100,000 Jews coming in your doorstep, you don't want these people. So you hate them, and you restrict them. And the Jews didn't have anywhere to go. The wandering Jew was the norm. Let's leave off with a final personality, a great Jew called Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, called Gersonides. He wrote a beautiful commentary on the Tanakh, and he was the first one that did the following. You know, the study of Musar, the study of Jewish ethics, is a very beautiful study. He was the first one that, after his commentating on the Bible, at the end of every so chapters, he would stop and say, okay, I'm going to now summarize all the ethical teachings which we can actually get out of this, of the last few chapters. And it's very, very, it's called Ralbag, Reb Levi ben Gershon. And it's very interesting commentary on the Tanakh, because although you read through it, it's quite tedious, but at the end of, let's say, every seven chapters, what he does, he says, it's okay, now I'm going to teach you the 30 or so character-building traits which we can learn, or which we have learned over the last few chapters. I must say, I taught the book of Samuel, the book of Shmuel, to students, and his commentary on Shmuel is terrific. It's terrific. At the end of chapter, I think, 7 and 13, he gives these summaries. And for a teacher in a classroom, it's brilliant. Because when you're a teacher in a classroom, what you want to do is you want to teach a verse, a story, and then you say to the children, okay, now, what can we learn from this story? Well, the Ralbag does it all for you. He says, okay, here's 5 points which you can learn from it. And it really is a super-duper commentary. To be fair to him, he was he was also a great philosopher, mathematician, astronomer, and he wrote some quite, some critiques of Maimonides' works, and in fact, for some of the things which he wrote, he was considered a bit of a radical for some of the works which he wrote, and was criticized for it. But his commentary on the Tanakh remained supreme, and he remained well known from it. I suppose, to summarize, the Ralbag, when he wanted to revise his commentary on the Chumash, he had to do it all from memory, because there was not a copy of the Talmud where he could draw from. This is an interesting thing. You'll find that the rabbis of that era, because the church had taken away many, many editions of the Talmud, they had to write their commentaries from memory. This brings us to an end of 300 years of Jewish France, a period of great turmoil, but in terms of produce, in terms of writings, phenomenal. In fact, we wouldn't understand the Talmud today without Rashi, or the Chumash for that matter. And so here we have the Jewish paradox. 300 years of crusades, killing, martyrdom, etc. And what do we get out of it? Misery and excellence. Because the olive, when you squeeze it, the oil comes out. And that's the Jew. Often it's been in times of great persecution that it's brought out the best in some of us. And wherever we've been, whichever country, there's always been that figure, personality, group of people, yeshiva, community, which has always been there to receive and help others. There has always been a place where we've been able to go to. I suppose the worst time I can think of a modern parallel was 1939, where in fact almost all the places were shut off. However, in those days, had it not been for one, true, the Jews were on the move, but had it not been for one noble being more kind to the Jews than the others, then it really is a period that Jews should have been eradicated from Europe, and that Jewish learning should not have been able to survive, and yet we find that both of them did. And this can only be due to divine providence. And it is a miracle that Judaism survived and our texts survived. The very fact that we have these texts which have gone down to us is in fact a miracle in itself. Next week, please God, we shall study the similar period of Jews in Germany. We'll also look at England. We'll also look at Spain, bringing us up to the 15th century. I'm not sure next week whether we'll get to the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, but this is where we'll be heading, hopefully, either next week or the week after that, to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. And thereafter, we'll be heading east to Eastern Europe. Thank you.